Welcome to The Book Report, the first show of 2014. Happy New Year. I'm your host, Elaine Charles, and I've got some resolutions you will love. I promise they don't involve calorie counting, extended gym workouts, or closet cleaning. Let's resolve to catch up on the season's top books. I've done my research and compiled suggestions from varied sources, everything from Amazon to The Guardian in the UK. The result? A great mix of mystery, thrillers, and nonfiction. A title for every taste. So let's start this new year off right and turn to page one of the book report. What if you could live again and again until you got it right? Here's a title found on most everyone's best of lists. Life After Life by Kate Atkinson. On a cold and snowy night in 1910, Ursula Todd is born to an English banker and his wife. She dies before she can draw her first breath. On that same snowy night, Ursula Todd is born, lets out a lusty wail, and embarks on a life that will be unusual. For as she grows, she also dies, repeatedly, in a variety of ways, while the young century marches on towards its second cataclysmic world war. Does Ursula's apparently infinite number of lives give her the power to save the world from its inevitable destiny? And if she can, will she? Fenella Woolgar performs this darkly comic, utterly original novel.
Snow. 11th of February, 1910.
For God's sake, girl, stop running around like a headless chicken and fetch some hot water and towels. Do you know nothing? Were you raised in a field?
Sorry, sir.
Bridget dipped an apologetic curtsy, as if Dr. Fellows were minor royalty.
A girl, Dr. Fellows? May I see her?
Yes, Mrs. Todd. A bonny, bouncing baby girl.
Sylvie thought Dr. Fellows might be over-egging the pudding with his alliteration. He was not one for bonhomie at the best of times. The health of his patients, particularly their exits and entrances, seemed designed to annoy him.
She would have died from the cord around her neck. I arrived at Fox Corner in the nick of time, literally.
Dr. Fellows held up his surgical scissors for Sylvie's admiration. They were small and neat, and their sharp points curved upwards at the end.
"Snip, snip," he said.
Sylvie made a mental note, a small, vague one, given her exhaustion and the circumstances of it, to buy just such a pair of scissors, in case of similar emergency. Unlikely it was true. Or a knife, a good, sharp knife to be carried on one's person at all times, like the robber girl in The Snow Queen.
"You were lucky I got here in time," Dr. Fellows said, "before the snow closed the roads. I called for Mrs. Haddock, the midwife, but I believe she is stuck somewhere outside Chalfont St. Peter."
"Mrs. Haddock," Sylvie said, and frowned.
Bridget laughed out loud, and then quickly mumbled,
"Sorry, sorry, sir."
Sylvie supposed that she and Bridget were both on the edge of hysteria. Hardly surprising.
"Bog Irish," Dr. Fellows muttered.
"Bridget's only a scullery maid, a child herself. I'm very grateful to her. It all happened so quickly." Sylvie thought how much she wanted to be alone, how she was never alone.
"You must stay until morning, I suppose, Doctor," she said reluctantly.
"Well, yes, I suppose I must," Dr. Fellows said, equally reluctantly.
Sylvie sighed and suggested that he help himself to a glass of brandy in the kitchen, and perhaps some ham and pickles.
"Bridget will see to you."
She wanted rid of him. He had delivered all three of her children, and she did not like him one bit. Only a husband should see what he saw, pawing and poking with his instruments in her most delicate and secretive places. But would she rather have a midwife called Mrs. Haddock deliver her child? Doctors for women should all be women themselves. Little chance of that. Dr. Fellows lingered, humming and hawing, overseeing the washing and wrapping of the new arrival by a hot-faced Bridget. Bridget was the eldest of seven, so she knew how to swaddle an infant.
She was 14 years old, 10 years younger than Sylvie. When Sylvie was 14, she was still in short skirts, in love with her pony, Tiffin. Had no idea where babies came from. Even on her wedding night, she remained baffled. Her mother, Lottie, had hinted, but had fallen shy of anatomical exactitude. Conjugal relations between man and wife seemed, mysteriously, to involve larks sawing at daybreak. Lottie was a reserved woman. Some might have said narcoleptic. Her husband, Sylvie's father, Llewellyn Beresford, was a famous society artist, but not at all bohemian. No nudity or louche behaviour in his household. He had painted Queen Alexandra when she was still a princess, said she was very pleasant. They lived in a good house in Mayfair, while Tiffin was stabled in a mews near Hyde Park. In darker moments, Sylvie was wont to cheer herself up by imagining that she was back there in the sunny past, sitting neatly in her side saddle on Tiffin's broad little back, trotting along Rotten Row on a clean spring morning, the blossom bright on the trees.
"How about some hot tea and a nice bit of buttered toast, Mrs. Todd?" Bridget said.
"That would be lovely, Bridget." The baby, bandaged like a pharaonic mummy, was finally passed to Sylvie. Softly she stroked the peachy cheek and said, "Hello, little one," and Dr. Fellows turned away so as not to be a witness to such syrupy demonstrations of affection.
We've just heard Life After Life by Kate Atkinson. David Baldacci became a writer to watch in 1996 with the publication of his first novel, Absolute Power. A film adaptation followed with Clint Eastwood as its director and star. In total, David has published 27 best-selling novels, many of which have been adapted for film and TV. A lifelong Virginian, David earned his law degree from the University of Virginia and went on to practice law in Washington, D.C. David and his wife have established the Wish You Well Foundation, supporting family and adult literacy in the United States. In 2008, the foundation partnered with Feeding America to launch Feeding Body and Mind, a program addressing the connection between literacy, poverty, and hunger. Through Feeding Body and Mind, more than 1 million new and used books have been collected and distributed through food banks to families in need. I'm really looking forward to speaking with David today about his new title, King and Maxwell, so let's get to it. Welcome, David. It's great to have you back with us on the Book Report.
Oh, thank you.
Your longtime fans are devoted to Sean King and Michelle Maxwell. How do you manage to introduce them to new readers while moving the story along for returning fans?
Well, I think you can read it as a little bit of a standalone because I give you enough information about who they are and where they come from. So if this is the first one you've picked up, you won't be totally lost, although it helps to have read some of the others. And for the returning fans, I think that twofold. One is they have to have an interesting plot or mystery they have to solve, but I think that returning fans want to see their relationship grow and expand and evolve, and I've tried to do that in this novel.
Right. So in this novel, introduce us to Tyler Wingo.
He is a 16-year-old kid whose dad is in the military, and he is running through a thunderstorm with a gun, and he's almost hit by King and Maxwell as they're driving down the road, and they stop and try to help him. And he has just learned from the Army that his dad has been killed in action in Afghanistan. But a couple of days later, he gets a coded email from his father that shows that maybe his dad is not dead, and that's why he brings on King and Maxwell to try to figure out what is going on.
Right. And as the book opens, as you say, we meet his dad on a secret military mission driving a truck through Afghanistan. He travels on to Pakistan and over the Khyber Pass. To set the scene so effectively, do you speak with returning vets?
I know a lot of military personnel in the Washington, D.C. area. There are a lot of them, obviously, and a lot of them are my friends. And I know people in all branches of the military, and I certainly talked with a lot of them. One, to try to understand, you know, the pressures and the stresses that military families have. Certainly the bereavement sequence I wanted to get right because that was so personal and important and sensitive. So, I did a lot of research in order to try to get it as accurate as I possibly could.
In this book, you kept me really intrigued with Tyler's stepmom, Jean. Can you fill us in a little about her?
Yeah, in a lot of my books, I try to create characters that are not what they seem to be. So she's a stepmom. She's obviously very upset that her husband has been killed, and she's trying to wrangle and help Tyler. But as the story goes on, you realize that Jean is really not what you thought Jean was supposed to be. And that's an element that I think adds to intrigue to the story and also makes it complicated.
Yeah, that, I really liked her. All right, email and texting are so central to the King and Maxwell plot. What's your opinion of governmental monitoring of private communications to ostensibly keep us safe?
Yeah, it's, I think the pendulum has swung too far the other way. And when I was in law school, one of the edicts we learned was that the slippery slope is indeed slippery. And we want to be safe, but we also want to have our privacy. It's a very tricky balance. I think that with all the media stories coming out now, the pendulum is going to swing back towards more privacy and not having the government intrude. But, you know, with that said, there are a lot of corporations. You know, when you go on and do a search online and you do a Google search or you go buy something, they're data mining everything that you're doing. They see exactly what you're buying, what you're looking at, and they sell that information to other retailers. This is why you get lots of emails from other people saying, oh, I saw you bought this, and I think you'd really like that. So no matter what we do online, there's going to be somebody watching.
Right. We meet Sean's ex-wife for the first time in this book. Do you have other characters waiting in the wings for future novels?
Yeah, I do. I mentioned her very briefly in the very first King of Maxwell, a split second, and I sort of held her in my back pocket until this book, and I thought this would be a great time to bring her out, because Sean and Michelle's characters have evolved and their relationships have evolved to where the ex-wife would be meaningful, a meaningful foil, certainly for Michelle, and an awkward one for Sean. So I'll do that with a series that I have. I have another one with my military guy, John Puller, where I have a family member sort of waiting in the wings for him to shine in a future book.
Well, as you say, Sean and Michelle are just partners, but what's so great about this story is that there's something more brewing between them. How do you manage to keep up that tension in their relationship?
That is a very tricky balance, too, because sometimes, you know, Moonlighting was a great show until they got together. So, you know, you have to sort of keep the tension, keep the possibilities, let them sort of put their toe in the water and then pull it back out. So with me, it's balancing the professional with the personal. And I've let them become intimate in one other book and then pull back from there. And now they're more just professional. But you know there's more. It's just that each of them have a hard time sort of trying to show that. And but once I jump that shark, there's no going back.
Right. We're speaking with David Baldacci on The Book Report. Well, with King and Maxwell as one of your recurring characters' storylines, do new storylines just bubble up for you when you're walking down the street or at odd moments?
Absolutely. I mean, you never know when an idea for a plot is going to hit you. And I like to travel. I like to meet new people and visit places. And I think the more that I learn about the world and people in general, it sort of fills up my well of ideas and possible plots. So it's not like you're born with a finite number of ideas, and then once you, you know, extinguish them, you're done. So I like to get out and see things. And I've always thought that the more I know about a lot of different things, the more compelling and complicated plots I can come up with.
Right. Well, I see that recently you've crossed over to a younger audience as well. Tell us about The Finisher.
I spent 5 years writing that novel. I sold it under a pseudonym to Scholastic. It's going to come out in March. It's a fantasy that takes you to a brand new world that I think is really very original. I don't think anything else has really been written in this way before. When Scholastic bought it, they thought I was a Brit. They wanted me to come over from England and meet with them because I was under a pseudonym. They were stunned to learn that it was actually me. And Sony Columbia bought the film rights for it a couple of months ago. They see it could be sort of like a Hunger Games, Harry Potter franchise for them, because it's one of a multiple number of books that I plan to write on this. So it's been quite a leap for me, but I loved it. Because, you know, with my novels, I have to, you know, I write fiction, but everything has to be based on fact, and I can't have people flying, you know, without benefit of a plane and things like that. So with the fantasy, I was able to just let my imagination run.
Well, how do you juggle all the projects that you're working on? Do you work at one at a time, or do you work on multiples?
Well, during the course of the day, I might work on two or three different projects. You know, you work on something for 2 or 3 hours, and you're extinguished with that. I have nothing left that I can add to that today. But instead of just going home and not doing anything else, I jump over to something else and keep going because it's just fun for me. I think that's one reason I'm so prolific. I've never treated writing as a job. It's just wonderfully fun for me. I feel like I'm just a kid again, you know, writing my little stories like I used to do back in Richmond.
You're lucky. So is there another King and Maxwell novel in the works, or what's next?
Well, next year in February, I have an ebook only coming out. It's like a long short story or a short novella where I bring back the Camel Club and combine them with Will Robey from my other series. And in March, The Finisher is published. And then April, I have a full-length thriller coming out called The Target, and that's going to bring Will Robey and Jessica Reel back from the novel last year called The Hit.
I so was amazed at your philanthropy, Feeding Body and Mind. How can readers help? And tell us a little more about it.
Yeah, 15 years ago, my wife and I founded the Wishiwell Foundation, and we support and fund literacy efforts across the United States. We've done programs in about all 50 states and counting. And we also have a program called Feeding Body and Mind. We partner with Feeding America, which runs all the nation's food banks, and we collect books, my book tours, and ship those to food banks around the country. We've collected in the last 4 years over 1 million books. The idea being that people seeking food assistance often have low literacy skills, low job skills. They can't be really financially independent. So food keeps them alive but doesn't break them out of a cycle of poverty. So what we try to do is get books, literacy, reading into the forefront of their lives, in their homes, in the lives of their children. With those higher reading skills, higher literacy skills lead to better jobs and more independent and productive life.
So how could a reader help? Could a reader make a donation?
You can go to either davidbaldacci.com and click on philanthropy, or you can go to wishyouwellfoundation.org, and that'll tell you a lot of the details you need to know if you want to help.
All right. Well, David, any final thoughts?
I just, you know, I'm glad people will continue to enjoy the books, and I certainly enjoy writing them.
Well, and we certainly enjoy reading them. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
All righty, bye. And now, let's hear a sampling of King and Maxwell, performed by Ron McLarty and Orla Cassidy.
He worked his way toward the mountains in the distance. He carried not one piece of personal information on him. Yet he did have papers that should allow him safe passage through the area. Should, not would. If he was stopped, he would have to talk his way out of it if the papers were deemed insufficient. If they asked to see what was in the truck, he had to refuse. If they insisted, he had a little metal box with a black matte finish. It had a switch on the side and one red button on top. When he engaged the switch and pushed down the button, everything would still be okay. If his finger came off the button while the device was still engaged, he and everything else within 20 square meters would disappear. He drove for 12 straight hours and saw not a single living person. He glimpsed a camel and a donkey wandering around. He saw a dead snake. He observed a rotted human body, its carcass being reduced to bone by vultures. He was surprised there was only one dead body. Normally, there would have been a lot more. This country had seen its share of slaughter. Every so often, another country tried to invade it. They quickly won the war and then lost everything else and went home with their tanks tucked between their legs. During the dozen hours, he saw the sun set and then rise again. He was heading east, so he was driving right into it. He lowered the visor on the truck and kept going. He played CD after CD of rock music, blasting the truck cab. He listened to Meatloaf's Paradise by the Dashboard Light 20 times in a row, as loud as his ears could stand. He smiled every time the baseball announcer's voice came on. It was a little bit of home out here. Despite Meatloaf screaming at him, his eyelids still drooped, and he kept jolting back awake after his truck had strayed across the road. Luckily, there was no other traffic. There weren't many people who would want to live around here. Foreboding would be one way to describe it. Insanely dangerous would be another, more accurate one. 13 hours into the trip, he grew so tired that he decided to pull off the road to take a quick nap. He had made good progress and had a little time to spare. But as he was about to stop, he looked down the road and saw what was coming. His weariness vanished. His nap would have to wait. The open bed truck was speeding directly at him, The truck was driving squarely in the center of the road, blocking passage in either direction. Two men sat in front. Three stood in the bed, all holding subguns. They were the welcome wagon, Afghan style. He pulled partially off the road, rolled down the window, let the heat waves push in, and waited. He turned off the CD player, and Meatloaf's baritone vanished. These men would not appreciate the rocker's prodigious pipes or lustful lyrics. The smaller truck stopped beside his. While two of the turbaned men with subguns pointed their weapons at him, the man in the truck's passenger seat climbed out and walked to the cab door of the other vehicle. He also wore a turban. The bands of sweat soaked into the material spoke of the prolonged intensity of the heat. The driver looked at the man as he approached. He reached for the sheaf of papers on the front seat. They sat next to his fully loaded Glock, with one round already in the chamber. He hoped he didn't have to use it, because a pistol against a subgun would only have one outcome, his death. "Papers?" the man said in Pashto. He handed them through. They were appropriately signed and distinctively sealed by each of the tribal chieftains who control these stretches of land. He was counting on it that they would be honored. He was encouraged by the fact that in this part of the world, not abiding by a chieftain's orders often resulted in the death of those who disobeyed.
That was King and Maxwell by David Baldacci. The Flamethrowers by Rachel Kushner begins in 1975. Reno has come to New York intent on turning her fascination with motorcycles and speed into art. Her arrival coincides with an explosion of activity in the art world as artists stake their claim to Soho and the East Village. Reno meets a group of dreamers who submit her to a sentimental education of sorts. Ardent, vulnerable, and bold, she begins an affair with an artist named Sandro Valera, the semi-estranged scion of an Italian tire and motorcycle empire. When the couple visit Sandro's family home in Italy, Reno falls in with members of the radical movement making headlines. Betrayal sends Reno reeling into a clandestine undertow, and she becomes a woman on the verge. Christina Traister narrates.
He had come a long way to that moment of quick violence, to braining a German soldier with a motorbike headlamp, and then taking the soldier's dagger, his pistol, his gas mask, no longer of use to him. Such a long way. From a placid childhood that faced the African sea, in which every young boy's game was a set of silhouettes against a clean division of water and sky, vast and limitless, a sea smooth and convex as a glassmaker's bubble, stretching and welling as if the aquamarine water were a single molten plasma. Valera spent hours on his family's balcony in Alexandria. Flaubert had done this before him, on his trip down the Nile in a felucca with Maxime Ducamp. Coptic monks had swum up to the boat, naked, begging alms. "Bakshish, bakshish," the monks cried out. The felucca's sailing crew hollering back this or that about Muhammad and attempting to cudgel the monks with frying pans and mop handles. He was busy supplementing his strict lycée education with Rimbaud and Baudelaire, with Flaubert's letters, volumes he purchased on trips to Paris with his father. His father proudly paid the extra customs fees for Valera's crates of literature, unaware that some of it was not only improper but downright lewd, like Flaubert's letters from the year he went down the Nile, 1849. Pages were passed among schoolboys, creased and underlined, depicting a life that confirmed the essential goodness of everything the boys had been told was bad. Valera longed for a French girl named Marie, closing his eyes to close the physical gap between their two bodies, as he pretended his own hand was Marie's lips, mouth, and tongue. Dark-eyed, pale-skinned Marie, who lived at the convent next door. She was older than Valera, but she let him hold her hand and even kiss her, though nothing more. The promise of her body was buried underneath layers of no and not yet. Every morning the girls were taken into the convent courtyard by the nuns, and Valera would strain at the kitchen window to see them doing their knee bends and stretches. On occasion, the sun angled in such a way that it penetrated the girls' thin white cotton blouses, and he was able to glimpse the shape of Marie's breasts, which were round and large. They were not suspended in any kind of undergarment, like the complicated muslin and elastic holsters his mother wore, and he wondered if brassieres were only for married women.
That was The Flamethrowers by Rachel Kushner. Jimmy Rabbit is back. The man who invented the commitments in the 80s is now 47, with a loving wife, four kids, and bowel cancer. No, he's not dying, but his life is changing. In The Guts by Roddy Doyle, Jimmy still loves music and still loves to hustle. Seems his new thing is finding old bands, then finding the people who love them enough to want their resurrected singles and albums. On his path through Dublin, he meets two of the commitments, Outspan, whose own illness is probably terminal, and Imelda Quirk, gorgeous as ever. Lawrence Kinlan performs this warm, funny novel about friendship and family, and about facing death and opting for life.
Facebook. Yeah. It's a social network. What's that? How come every time I say something, some asks me a question? Too shay, says Jimmy Sr. Listen, said Jimmy. Your phone there. Your mobile. Yeah. Your contacts. Your friends and their numbers, your kids, all the numbers you'd want. Facebook's a bit like that, except with pictures. So it's just a list of people's numbers and emails. No, said Jimmy, there's more to it than that. But that's the start, the foundation of it, I suppose. Friends. You're going for a pint. Do you phone the lads to see if they're going? No point, said Jimmy Sr. I know the answer. Just go with me on this one, da, said Jimmy. I'm trying to educate you. Go on. You're going for a pint, like, and you want to know if your buddy, Bertie, will be there. Do you phone him? No, said Jimmy Sr. Not anymore. You text him, yeah? Yeah. And he texts back. He never stops. His mobile buzzed and crawled an eighth of an inch across the table. There's the now. He picked up the phone and stared at it. He took his reading glasses out of his shirt pocket, put them on and stared at it again. Your mother, he said. She wants milk. He put the phone down and took off his glasses. She used to be able to walk to the shops herself, he said. She was very good at it. He texts you back, said Jimmy. Yeah, or something, and you text him, Grant. That's right, said Jimmy Sr. That sounds like a day of my life. Well, that's social networking, said Jimmy. More or less, it's like a club, but you have your own room for the people you want to meet, except there's no room and you meet no one, unless you want to. A club? That's the best way to see it. Grand. Why? Why what? Jimmy watched his dad look across the bar, squint, wait, and lift his hand, one finger up. Did he see me? Think so. Jimmy Sr. was having another point. He knew Jimmy wasn't. Why do you ask about Facebook? Something Bertie told me, said Jimmy Sr. Something he heard. It's illegal if it's Bertie. No, said Jimmy Sr. It's not. It's f***ing immoral, but... You'll have to tell me now. I'm going to tell you. I've every intention of telling you. Is he working on me point over there? Jimmy pretended to look across at the bar and the barman he didn't know behind it. He is, yeah, he told his dad. Grand. Are you going blind? No. But no. It's like everything else. Jimmy knew what his dad meant, and it was a good place to give him his own news, but he couldn't do it. He wasn't ready. Bertie, he said. Bertie, said his dad. He told me his youngest fella, Gary, I think it is. He's about the same age as your Marvin. 17. About that, yeah. A year or two older. A little by all accounts. Anyway, he told Bertie, and Bertie told me that he, Gary, like, with all the women on Facebook. I heard about that, all right. Did you? I did, yeah. What sort of a club is that? A good one, said Jimmy.
That was The Guts by Roddy Doyle.
Macquarie was released just weeks after author Ian Banks' passing. Many believe it is among his greatest works. 18-year-old Kit is weird. Big, strange, odd, socially disabled, on a spectrum that stretches from highly gifted at one end to a nutter at the other. Kit and his father, Guy, live together in a decaying country house on the unstable brink of a vast quarry. But Guy is dying, and his old friends are gathering around him for one last time. It's a diverse and slightly bizarre group. But before Guy passes, Kit wants to know who his mother is and what exactly is on the mysterious tape they're all looking for. Peter Kenny performs the book that has been reviewed both as gripping and savagely funny.
Other people thinking that there are different types of cleverness was apparently what I was supposed to focus on. "Are you sure, Hull?" I asked patiently. "There you go." "There I go what?" "There you go, sounding sarcastic and patronizing." "But I wasn't being either. I was trying to sound patient." "Again, what you meant isn't what matters, Kit. What matters is how you appear, what other people think you meant." "It's not my problem if..." I began, then fell silent under a look from Hull. The look, concerned, involves her dipping her head a little to the right and her eyebrows rising while her lips purse a fraction. It was her look that says, as near as I can gauge it, "Now, Kit, we've been over this before." "It is your problem," she told me. "If you've given people the wrong impression when you could have given them the right one, you've..." "Yes, yes, yes. I need to make allowances for people," I said, wanting to get back to the proper point. I may have waved my hands too. "So what other sorts of cleverness are there?" Hull sighed. "Emotional cleverness, Kit. Empathising with others. Getting on with people. Intuiting what and how they think. But if people would just say what they..." I got the look again. Now it was my turn to sigh. "That's another area where I have to make allowances, isn't it?" "Yes, it is. Plus, people don't always know what they think themselves, Kit," Hull told me. And, in another turnaround, now she was sounding what you might call conspicuously patient. "Not precisely. Not so they can tell you clearly and unambiguously and without contradictions." She paused, probably waiting for me to protest that, well, people just should know what they think and express it properly. It was certainly what I was thinking, but I didn't say it. "And a lot of the time," she continued, when I just sat there and smiled the way she'd taught me, "even when people do know what they think and why, they don't always want to tell you." Another pause. "Sometimes because they don't want to hurt your feelings or give you something you might use against them later, either directly against them to their face or use against them by mentioning what's just been said to somebody else." "Gossip?" "Often, yes," Hull agreed and smiled. Hull has a plain face, but the consensus seems to be that it lights up when she smiles. I like to see her smile, and especially I like to see her smile at me, so I suppose this must be true. Hull has always been my favourite of Dad's old friends, not that he really has any new ones. Even before we came to our financial arrangement, I knew that I trusted her and I would listen to her and take her seriously. "Sometimes," she went on, "they're ashamed of what they're thinking, or just need more time to decide what they really, truly feel. Because emotions can get very, well, tangled." "So," I said, "what you're saying is, it's complicated." This is almost a joke between us. A lot of apparently simple things seem to end up being complicated. Hull nodded. "People are. Who'd have thunk?" I thought about this. "Well, everybody, obviously." Holly nodded. "Well, everybody else, Kit. So I ought to hide my light under a bushel. Oh, jeez, Kit. Have you been reading the Bible again? Have you? Is that where that's from?" "Yes. I mean, I think so." "No. But should I? Hide my light under a bushel, I mean." "Well, just don't insist on putting it under a magnifying glass." We were in the sitting room of the house, sitting on overstuffed but threadbare couches on either side of the large, interestingly warped coffee table. A large vase of black glass containing real flowers sat between us. Usually, we keep artificial flowers in this vase because real ones are such a bother, and the only reason the vase is there anyway is to catch drips falling from the water-stained ceiling directly above.
We've just heard The Quarry by Ian Banks. Claire Massoud's The Woman Upstairs has been called a brilliant new novel, the story of a woman awakened, transformed, and betrayed by passion and desire for a world beyond her own. Nora Eldridge is a 37-year-old elementary school teacher in Cambridge, Mass. Long ago, she abandoned her ambition to be a successful artist. She has become the woman upstairs, a reliable friend, a tidy neighbor, always on the fringe of others' achievements. Then Reza Shahid walks into her classroom, a child who enchants as if from a fairy tale. He and his parents, Dashing Skandar, a Lebanese scholar and professor, and Serena, an effortlessly glamorous Italian artist, have come to Boston for Skandar to take up a fellowship at Harvard. When Reza is attacked by schoolyard bullies who call him a terrorist, Nora is drawn into the complex world of the Shahid family. She finds herself falling in love with them, separately and together. Nora's happiness explodes her boundaries until Serena's careless ambition leads to a shattering betrayal. Cassandra Campbell narrates.
How angry am I? You don't want to know. Nobody wants to know about that. I'm a good girl. I'm a nice girl. I'm a straight-A, straight-laced, good daughter, good career girl, and I never stole anybody's boyfriend, and I never ran out on a girlfriend, and I put up with my parents' shit and my brother's shit, and I'm not a girl anyhow. I'm over 40 fucking years old, and I'm good at my job, and I'm great with kids, and I held my mother's hand when she died, after 4 years of holding her hand while she was dying, and I speak to my father every day on the telephone. Every day, mind you. And what kind of weather do you have on your side of the river? Because here, it's pretty gray and a bit muggy, too. It was supposed to say, great artist, on my tombstone. But if I died right now, it would say, such a good teacher slash daughter slash friend instead. And what I really want to shout and want in big letters on that grave, too, is F you all. Don't all women feel the same? The only difference is how much we know we feel it, how in touch we are with our fury. We're all furies, except the ones who are too damned foolish. And my worry now is that we're brainwashing them from the cradle, and in the end, even the ones who are smart will be too damned foolish. What do I mean? I mean the second graders at Appleton Elementary, sometimes the first graders even, and by the time they get to my classroom, to the third grade, they're well and truly gone. They're full of Lady Gaga and Katy Perry and French manicures and cute outfits, and they care how their hair looks. In the third grade, they care more about their hair or their shoes than about galaxies or caterpillars or hieroglyphics. How did all that revolutionary talk of the 70s land us in a place where being female means playing dumb and looking good? Even worse on your tombstone than dutiful daughter is looked good. Everyone used to know that. But we're lost in a world of appearances now. That's why I'm so angry, really. Not because of all the chores and all the making nice and all the duty of being a woman, or rather of being me, because maybe these are the burdens of being human. Really, I'm angry because I've tried so hard to get out of the Hall of Mirrors, this sham and pretend of the world, or of my world, on the east coast of the United States of America in the first decade of the 21st century. And behind every mirror is another f***ing mirror, and down every corridor is another corridor. And the fun house isn't fun anymore, and it isn't even funny. But there doesn't seem to be a door marked exit. At the fair each summer when I was a kid, we visited the funhouse. with its creepy, grinning plaster face 2 stories high. You walked in through its mouth, between its giant teeth, along its hot pink tongue. Just from that face, you should have known. It was supposed to be a lark, but it was terrifying. The floors buckled or they lurched from side to side, and the walls were crooked, and the rooms were painted to confuse perspective. Lights flashed, horns blared. In the narrow, vibrating hallways lined with fattening mirrors and elongating mirrors and inside-out, upside-down mirrors. Sometimes the ceiling fell or the floor rose or both happened at once, and I thought I'd be squashed like a bug. The funhouse was scarier by far than the haunted house, not least because I was supposed to enjoy it. I just wanted to find the way out. But the doors marked exit led only to further crazy rooms, to endless moving corridors. There was one route through the funhouse, relentless to the very end. I've finally come to understand that life itself is the funhouse. All you want is that door marked exit, the escape to a place where real life will be. And you can never find it. No, let me correct that.
That was The Woman Upstairs by Claire Massoud. Tom Kizia's Pilgrim's Wilderness, a true story of faith and madness on the Alaska frontier, is a riveting true story of a modern-day homesteading family deep in the Alaskan wilderness, and of the chilling secrets of its maniacal, spellbinding patriarch. Reviewers agree with author John Krakauer, who comments, "Pilgrim's Wilderness lends credence to the maxim that unadulterated truth, when conveyed with sufficient skill, is not only more illuminating than fiction, but also more entertaining." When Papa Pilgrim appeared in the Alaskan frontier outpost of McCarthy with his wife and 15 children, his new neighbors had little idea of the trouble to come. The Pilgrim family seemed a shining example of the homespun Christian ideal, but their true story ran dark and deep. Within weeks, Papa had bulldozed a road through the mountains to the new family home, sparking a tense confrontation with the National Park Service. He forced his ghost town neighbors to take sides in a volatile battle over where a citizen's rights end and the government's power begins. Veteran Alaska journalist Tom Kizia discovered Papa Pilgrim was in fact the son of a rich Texas family with ties to Hoover's FBI, strange oblique connections to the Kennedy assassination, and the movie stars of Easy Rider. As his fight with the Alaskan government grew more intense, the turmoil in his brood made it increasingly difficult to tell whether his children were messianic followers or hostages in desperate need of rescue. Listeners, you may want to opt for the print version of this book, as reviewers were not very fond of Fred Sanders' narration.
The Pilgrims knew nothing of this history, but they liked what it had left behind. 420 acres of patented private holdings surrounded by miles and miles of protected public land. They snow machined up and down the valley to explore. They poked into the cavity in the mountain high overhead. They examined the overgrown gravel runway on the Spokane Placer and the 2 livable cabins on the marvelous mill site. They returned to McCarthy and drove to Fairbanks to meet Walt Wigger in a restaurant. He told them the National Park Service had made an offer, looking to buy up potentially troublesome inholdings from willing sellers, but he refused to sell to the government. Wigger was impressed by the Pilgrim family's size and single-minded drive, though he warned them the narrow mountain valley was a hungry country. The family patriarch didn't seem worried. He said God had chosen the valley to be their home. It dawned on the old miner that God might be willing for them to pay just about any price. They agreed on $450,000, twice the offer from the national park, which had been bound by strict agency appraisal rules. Pilgrim had his own binding rules. The book of Ezekiel, among others, speaks against extracting usury. He agreed to pay in annual increments of $30,000 without interest. They wrote out the deal on a table napkin. Pilgrim turned to a daughter, Hosanna, who produced a shoebox with the first payment in rolls of $100 bills. After 3 years, the big family's annual Alaska Permanent Fund dividend payments from the state's investments of oil revenues, $1,963.86 per person the previous year, had accumulated nicely. Papa Pilgrim was gleeful. The family returned to Old McCarthy Town, as Pilgrim had started calling it, to celebrate with their new friends and neighbors. There would be music and dancing at the McCarthy Lodge. Snow still lingered, but the days were getting longer, and the springtime sun was bright at 8 that evening when the family appeared on the street, striding toward the saloon with their instruments. Pete McCarthy, still in town doing research, wrote that they looked like they were headed to a gunfight, though only Papa wore a pistol on his belt. Neil and Doug had laid out food on the breakfast table because the Pilgrims would not enter the saloon. Pilgrim introduced his wife, Country Rose, a redoubtable woman with a tired half-smile who sometimes played a stand-up bass, and then the children by name, the older musicians from before, and now the mid-sized sprouts, Job, Noah, and Abraham, and the little blonde girls, Psalms, Lamb, and Bethlehem. He announced that their new home up McCarthy Creek would henceforth be known as Hillbilly Heaven. He said this with a Santa Claus sparkle in eyes that Pete McCarthy noticed were extremely bright. The British writer, reveling in the strangeness of his namesake Alaska town, was utterly charmed. "The kids have spotted the cheese and fruit and cake and cookies, but make no attempt to eat until someone offers the food around. A couple of them have bare feet. I'm not sure whether they took their boots off at the door or whether they walked down here in the snow like that. They take the instruments out of their cases and sit in a semicircle. There are 26 people in the room, and 16 of them are pilgrims. Pa makes a little speech of welcome, and then they start playing. It's electrifying, moving, and raw. Elisheba, the eldest, alternates lead vocals with 19-year-old Joshua as they trade licks on their violins. They have powerful cutting voices, strengthened by singing outdoors, and sound like themselves rather than imitations of anyone else."
We've just heard Pilgrim's Wilderness by Tom Kizia. Readers, I've spoken with dozens of top authors working on their 2014 releases. There is so much ahead for us. For ongoing updates, you can always reference my website, bookreportradio.com. I hope you resolve to keep on coming back for the latest from the book world. Thanks for joining me today on show number one of 2014. Let's meet again next week on The Book Report.